supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Jury selection gets underway Monday for Bill Cosby's upcoming criminal sexual assault retrial. Good evening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight. Cosby is charged with 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault for allegedly drugging and sexually assaulting a woman named Andrea Constant in 2004. All this week, attorneys for both sides battled it out in hearings on what evidence to include in the new trial. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has just returned from the courthouse in Norristown and joins me now. Laura, what happened during pretrial hearings this week to shape how the trial might look?
So there were a couple days of hearings this week, yesterday and today, hearings last week as well, and they're just to deal with this kind of hodgepodge of questions before Judge Stephen O'Neill. He has to decide what evidence can come into the trial, what jurors are going to be allowed to know and consider when they're making their decision whether to convict or acquit Bill Cosby of those sexual assault charges. So some of the things that he heard in the last couple of days were, you know, whether information about the Montgomery County District Attorney's campaign could come in. He campaigned against his rival, saying, "My rival never charged Cosby," and sort of implying that that was a big mistake. You know, things like how many what they're calling supporting witnesses can come in. So we know that the judge ruled earlier in the month that there could be 5 other women who have accused Bill Cosby of drugging and sexually assaulting them, that those women can testify. But the prosecution wants to have sort of a little bit of backup. So they know that those women's accounts are going to be challenged. And so they'd like to be able to call some supporting witnesses to say, to sort of show that those women either talked about those accusations or those events at the time that they happened, and kind of to shore them up. We don't know if those supporting witnesses will be let in. The one big thing the judge did rule on was his own role. The defense had asked him to recuse himself because they said that the fact that his wife is a social worker who works for a program at the University of Pennsylvania to address sexual assault and trauma, that that somehow compromised or biased him. And he really refuted that. He ruled yesterday, he read a prepared statement and said, you know, he thought that motion by the defense trivialized his wife's work and implied a bias that simply wasn't there. But there's still a lot we don't know.
And so toward that end, with opening arguments scheduled at this juncture to get underway a week from Monday, April 9th, what is still up in the air?
I mean, there's a lot. A lot of those things I mentioned in my last response, we still don't know. We don't know about the DA's race. We don't know about the supporting witnesses. We don't know this huge piece, which is Bill Cosby faced his accuser in court, in civil court, in the mid-2000s, and they had a large settlement. And the terms of that settlement have been private. We don't know exactly what the negotiations look like. We don't know how much money Andrea Constant received. And the defense and the prosecution both want parts of this information to go before a jury. They think it helps their case. You know, on the one hand, they say the defense has said outright, like, they want to portray Andrea Constant as greedy and that she sort of set up Cosby. And on the other hand, the prosecution says, look, he was trying to cover his tracks. A not guilty person doesn't pay someone this much money and go through this much trouble if they don't have some sort of guilty conscience to conceal. So we don't know how much of that or what pieces of that are going to come in. And we also don't know if the defense is going to get their kind of dream witness, which is this woman named Margo Jackson, who worked with Andrea Constant. Andrea Constant worked at Temple University's women's basketball program. They worked together, and the defense hopes that she will show that Andrea's account is not very credible, but we don't know if she'll be allowed to testify yet.
One change: the defense team is being led by a high-profile attorney, Tom Mesereau. Any sense yet of what tact he might take?
He's been very aggressive, or I should say his team has been very aggressive. He has not been arguing a lot of the points of law himself. But just from what we've seen in the pretrial hearings, I mean, there's been a lot of there were raised voices today between someone on his team and an ADA where there were sort of accusations that, you know, people were not proffering the information between these two teams of lawyers that they're supposed to be. He asked the judge to recuse himself, which is a pretty aggressive tactic when you're about to try a case before that person's court. And from sort of all legal analysis, was not something that was it was not something that was going to happen, but it was something that he did as a very aggressive tactic and possibly to sway public opinion. We don't know. I think while any kind of criminal trial, there are going to be heated moments. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot more. And he's, you know, the gloves are off in this case, in this retrial.
Are the gloves going to be off or on starting Monday when a pool of 12 jurors and six alternates is selected from some 120 eligible Montgomery County residents?
That's a good question. I think it'll be interesting. This is a different county, different jury pool. Last time the jury came from Allegheny County. This time what we know is that questionnaires went out that the prosecution and the defense put together to try to start weeding out people. They have a list of 187 people who are going to be – they're going to start going through on Monday and start combing through these people to see, you know, do you have an opinion about whether or not Bill Cosby is already guilty? What do you know about this? You know, how do you feel about the Me Too movement? I'm not exactly sure what's on that questionnaire. That's not made public, but we know there are going to be a lot of fine questions and a lot of trying to sort of toss out anybody who may have any sort of prior opinion about the events in this case.
That there may be several more witnesses brought to the stand, does that impact how long this trial might go, and with that, how long jurors may be sequestered?
It certainly could. There was a lot of concern in court today about whether or not this would actually be many, many trials within the larger trial, right? Because if you have charges stemming from one alleged sexual assault, but then you have people talking about five other alleged sexual assaults in the space of that trial, and you're sort of grappling over the credibility of each of these people, that could really lengthen the case. And the defense did say, at not this week's pretrial hearings, but prior, that they wanted to warn the jury this could take up to a month.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you so much, Dave.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff on Newsworks Tonight. As congregants plan to attend houses of worship over this holiday weekend, let's pay tribute to an historic church in Philadelphia that no longer welcomes parishioners. Joining me is Plan Philly contributor Ashley Hahn. Ashley, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
Take us to this community and congregation in Washington Square West.
So St. Peter Claver Roman Catholic Church was founded in the late 1880s, and it was Philadelphia's first church for black Catholics.
Though the legacy of black Catholics in Philadelphia long predates the 1800s.
Absolutely. They've been here as long as Philadelphia's been here. And the earliest Catholic churches here did include black parishioners, many of whom did have to worship separately in some cases. They might have had to receive sacraments separately or be seated in different areas of a church. So that history of segregated worship led to the formation of St. Peter Claver Union, which was the founding mechanism for St. Peter Claver Church.
Describe that neighborhood in that time.
In the late 1800s, the neighborhood around where St. Peter Claver stands, which is at 12th and Lombard, was a very diverse community, and it happened to be the home for the city's largest population of black residents, largest and oldest. So a very rich community there, and it made good sense to put St. Peter Claver Church there. Fourth Presbyterian Church had been built in the 1840s. That congregation moved, and St. Peter Claver Union had the opportunity to purchase the church, which they did, and it was dedicated in 1892.
This church was one of several mother churches in the vicinity.
Indeed. Philadelphia has several mother churches among black congregations, such as Mother Bethel AME, not far away.
When did the unraveling begin, as it were?
The church has a school associated with it. In 1984, the school was closed. And in 1985, as St. Peter Claver looked to celebrate its centennial, it was informed that the parish would be suppressed. That's a technical term for the archdiocese, which means it will no longer permit sacraments to be given, such as baptism or weddings or funerals, to be held at that church. And that's a pretty quick way to diminish a parish.
But what was the calculus on the archdiocese part? Was it in response to diminished attendance and enrollment?
Yes. The archdiocese felt that they wanted to change the way they served the black Catholic community, and they felt it was not necessary to do so through St. Peter Claver per se, but through other parishes as well.
How did congregants respond?
Congregants were distraught, and they felt that it was time to start telling their story better. So they started archiving and documenting the meaning of this place to them. And I spoke with Adrienne Harris, whose family grew up in that church, and here's what she had to say about her feelings about St. Peter Claver.
I don't want it sold. I think the history is too important, especially at this time when this country is so racially divided and things are so ugly. This is not a time to throw out Black history.
St. Peter Claver was more than a church. It was people's school community, it was their social community, and it provided a really rich network for the people who were participants in it, often for generations. People would be baptized there, and their parents would be memorialized there. They would go to school there. They were married there. It's every major life event was touched by this place in some way. It's more than just a house of worship. It's a spiritual heart, and it's their rock.
So that you described Archdiocese efforts going back to the mid-80s, it took until 2014 for the church to officially close. Is that because congregants were able to at least slow down, if not stop the process?
Yes, the congregants were able to pump the brakes, but they were not able to ultimately fight the Archdiocese successfully. They appealed to anybody that they could think to appeal to, including the Pope and the Office of Black Catholics, and they were able to still celebrate Mass there for some time. In 1994, the building turned into the St. Peter Claver Center for Evangelization to serve the Black Catholic community, but that meant it was not hosting regular Masses any longer.
And then outside the church, there was a recent court action that even further accelerated the process.
Yes. So amid the recent batch of parish closures and consolidations, the Archdiocese sought to have language stripped from the deed for St. Peter Claver, which limited its sale and had racial limitations on its use. A court decision in December has now enabled the Archdiocese to sell the property, with the caveat that a portion of the proceeds be used to benefit the Black Catholic community, that is, the community that used to be served by St. Peter Claver. St. Peter Claver's school has been used as a women's shelter, Women of Hope operated, since the mid-80s. And because of the sensitivity of that population, the Archdiocese is holding off on marketing the property at this time.
Are there any caveats or provisions giving the building's historic certification?
Indeed, the building was designated historic by the city in the mid-80s, which means that the building is protected through a local designation, which means that any alterations proposed for the building or a demolition would require permission from the city's historical commission first.
Ashley Hahn, thanks so much for coming in and offering perspective.
So glad to be here.
Plan Philly contributor Ashley Hahn on NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia has dozens of different government agencies. There's the police department, parks and recreation, the fire department, the school district, and more. But only one has its own gift shop. Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly offers this story about SEPTAs, trolleys, and trains, and the people who love them.
If you can slap a SEPTA logo on it, Peg McGuire probably sells it.
Sweatshirts, t-shirts, hats, bags. Magnets, keychains.
McGuire is the store manager of SEPTA's gift shop, located on the first floor of the transit agency's offices in Center City.
Train displays, books. The books are huge.
This year's hot item?
Believe it or not, this is our most popular one, the fanny pack. It's come back. We refer to it as the waste pack.
McGuire says about half the customers are SEPTA employees, people who take pride in their job and want to show off where they work. The other half, rail fans. That's the name for people who are just really into trains.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be model trains that they're into. Their hobby is transportation. Their hobby is going out and riding the buses or riding the trains, riding the subway, riding the L.
Recently, I tagged along with some guys who do just that every year on the Saturday before the Super Bowl.
All right, folks, welcome aboard. This is our 25th. Yes, 25th Super Saturday Streetcar Special.
That's Steve Barry, editor of Railfan and Railroad Magazine. Barry helps organize his trip every year, where he and other railfans rent out a SEPTA trolley for a day. This isn't one of those trolley-turned-bus things you see wedding parties sometimes use. This is an actual SEPTA trolley, driven by an actual SEPTA employee. The cost? $840 for the first 2 hours, and 230 per hour after that. On this trolley are about 30 guys, mostly older, we're talking 50s, 60s and above, plus one indulgent wife. And they don't just want to ride the train, they want to document the experience.
All right, folks, photo stop!
At designated stops, they get off the trolley to take pictures of the trolley. These guys have serious cameras, the stuff pros use. Heck, one guy even has a drone. I'm the only schmuck there using his iPhone.
I'll shoot anything that moves on rails.
Mike Burkhart is a regular on these charters. I ask him the question I'm asking everyone on this trip. What's up with you and trains?
And I get that all the time, and I don't. And I think you will find that if you talk to any of the guys on here, that they're probably going to have the same answer. They're not really sure. Maybe it's something in childhood. Maybe it's just the mechanics of it or the bigness of it or, you know, fascination. Everybody needs a hobby, right? So this is ours.
Burkhart's right. I talked to dozens of rail fans, and they all said the same thing. They just like trains. They don't know why or how it ever really began other than early when they were kids. The rail fans aren't alone in not really understanding why they fan on rails. Academics are equally stumped. There hasn't been much research on why people take up a hobby, let alone why they pick one over another. But one theory suggests that our self-esteem depends on acceptance from others. And when someone shares the same obscure interests as you, the one the other kids might have mocked you for, that creates a deep bond, not just with the person, but the hobby itself. That's what happened to Dave Warner, who points out his old friend sitting just a few seats away.
Bob Bitzer, who is there in the red hat, we've known each other since 1970, since I joined the chapter.
Wow.
So I was a teenager then, and here it is.
Warriors.
50 years later.
So what keeps him coming back? Here's Burkhart again.
The thing with this hobby is that it's never complete. There's always something else to go do. There's always something new. Always a new railroad, a new paint job, a new steam engine that comes online that might not have been around for years.
At a trolley loop next to the Mount Moriah Cemetery, all the guys gather for a group photo next to their trusty old streetcar. And while they get a shot together every year, this one's different. This is the first year the photo's been taken by a drone. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump's character was again called into question when 60 Minutes aired an interview between Anderson Cooper and Stormy Daniels. Nonetheless, Trump maintains high approval ratings among highly religious Protestants. Let's dive into the numbers with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, how is it that evangelicals seem to be a part of Trump's immovable base?
The question itself is very complex, but I can say that our data show that most highly religious white Protestants, and that's the functional equivalent of evangelicals, are Republicans. And the Republican identity is what really drives approval of Trump, it looks like to us, nothing specific about Trump himself. In fact, when you isolate these people and then look at how often they go to church, there's really not a lot of difference once you take into account the fact that they are Republicans and Protestant and white. Now, the real question I guess a lot of people ask is, why aren't they actually lower than other people in their approval of Trump, given what he's done in his life on long moral and value issues? And that's a really good question, because they are no less likely to approve of him than other Republicans, but actually they're not extraordinarily more likely either than what we predict based on their party identity.
Is it that evangelicals don't believe his accusers, or do they, in a more general sense, feel that President Trump is a means to an end?
Well, I believe, based on my research, that it's not a matter of what Trump per se as a man has done or not done. It's more that he represents a broad approach to society and society's problems, the conservative approach, this approach that tends to emphasize traditionalism and hierarchy and authority and structure. That's consistent between being highly religious and being a Republican and conservative in today's society. So I think it's these broader implications of what he represents that maintain that support among evangelicals for President Trump, despite the fact that he clearly doesn't live up to high moral standards that a lot of these people would say are important in general.
And is it in part that what he represents is perceived as better than the alternative?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's clear that in the election, of course, it was Hillary Clinton on the other side, but in general, the approach to society and our problems represented by the conservative approach is decidedly different than the approach represented by the liberal side of the equation. And there's a real consistency, the data show, between being highly religious and liking authority and traditionalism, as I mentioned, and that's embodied in the Republican Party in today's America.
One increasingly rare area of bipartisan accord is the need to spend for infrastructure.
Absolutely. Now, the problem is funding with all of this. Trump himself says, well, the federal government may kick in about $200 billion, but all the rest, which is another billion or more, would need to be kicked in by states and local entities and others, and that's a big stumbling block. The American public loves the idea of spending more money on infrastructure. Some of our questions even say $1 trillion with the T dollars of federal money on infrastructure, and the public says that's fine. So I think this is one of the few, as you mentioned, Dave, no-brainers we have in American politics today. The public would love for the government to get started with a massive program on fixing the nation's infrastructure.
Frank, when respondents are asked to look beyond the current election cycle, do they feel that the next generation may have it as good as the current one?
Actually, a majority do. And one of the reasons we just asked that question, we updated a trend, is because a lot of people have said, well, that's going away. There's pessimism now. It used to be that Americans said, well, there's always upward mobility. The next generation will be better off. Now Americans are growing more pessimistic, not sure about the future. But our data show that 61% of Americans say it is likely that today's youth will be better off than their parents. And that's actually up. It was down to 44% back in 2011. So Americans have clearly become more positive about the next generation. And that's one of the higher numbers we've seen on this trend throughout history.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Musoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.